We are two guys gaming. As always, even though the intro says two guys gaming, this is one guy reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this series, I am currently reading and reacting to The Dragon Republic Book 2 in the series by R.F. Kuang. It's only been 3 days since I last recorded. Woohoo! So I'm on schedule to get this done by the end of August and get on to the new book, which I announced at the end of the last episode. It will be Red Mars. Hopefully over the next week I can get the last two episodes done. I'm working on the notes for 5, and then I'll have to work on the notes for 6, and then I can just record them and get them out and move on to the next book, finally. In this episode, I will be covering chapters 18 through 24 of the book. As I've done over the last episode at least, and maybe the last couple episodes, I will first read the summary, and then I'll go over my thoughts for the chapter, then I will go through my general thoughts, I will wrap up, and we will both be done with what we're doing here. The summary comes from supersummary.com, not a sponsor, but I really like what they do with their summaries, so I've been using them. If they want to sponsor me, by all means, I'm open. Chapter 18, summary. Rin tells that Sika they've been disbanded. She excels at being a foot soldier and is content. She isn't in the war cabinet anymore, but is kept up to date by Katay, who is nervous that their ships will be caught in a freeze as winter approaches. Petra believes Rin is hiding her powers, and she subjects her to, quote, baser and baser experiments, end quote. After Petra taunts her with opium, Rin hits a wall in frustration. A young missionary named August tends to her wounds. He says that some of the Great Company find Petra's methods, quote unquote, conservative, though he still believes that, quote unquote, the white race is superior to the Nekara people. Against Katay and Nisha's advice, Jinza doesn't turn back to wait out the winter, instead continuing north. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 18. Rin, still powerless, leans into her new role as foot soldier. She starts by doing what she always does and pushes away those that care. She then buries her feelings behind a wall and uses the praise of a job well done to get high. That's some Olympic-level cope right there. While she might find some joy in the life of a foot soldier, ultimately she'll yearn for more. At first, losing our responsibilities feels like a dream for her. For me, it's a dream come true. Free to live my life as I want. Oh, but there's the catch. As a foot soldier, she has no responsibility. She also has little autonomy. So yeah, there's no way she finds this fulfilling long term. Until she discovers who she is. Absent the Sika, parenthetically check for now. The army, parenthetically unlikely anytime soon. And Altan, parenthetically in the process. She will continue to ping pong through personalities in search of that peace and freedom. It's something we all need to do. And she's still technically a kid, so it's going to take some time. She especially needs to be free of the Hesperian quote-unquote experiments. She meets a sympathetic ear in August. Colonialism is out there and ever-present. This race is superior to that one, etc., but many of us fight to keep it at bay or even reverse the effects. Even in a monoculture, not everyone thinks the same. Those of us willing to think differently and try different things need to meet one another, organize communities that mirror our values. Build everyone up instead of tearing them down. It hasn't been easy, and it won't be easy, but it is necessary. And at this point, it might even be vital. Shit's not getting better. There's two kinds of people, parenthetically, I know, reductive. Those who say, quote, life sucks, let's make it better for everyone else, end quote. And those who say, quote, life sucks, let's make it worse and show everyone that it sucks, end quote. Owning the libs, so to speak. That second line of thinking simply is not sustainable. It's already rotting from the festering wounds inside of it. Only a matter of time until it crumbles again. Wishful thinking? Perhaps. But why the fuck not? What else has gotten us there? Chapter 19 summary. A blizzard starts on the New Year's holiday. Nisha steals glutinous rice flour and Rin cooks pangyan. Katay asks what they think the next great military innovation will be. Nisha says arquebuses, while Rin says shamanic armies. Nisha thinks Rin's idea is dangerous and impractical. Rin leaves to go to the bathroom and trips over a mass grave of frozen children. Katay hypothesizes that the frozen villagers were running from the Dragon Republic's army. They are plagued by snowstorms, but Jin Zhao won't turn back. He wants to take a strategic city called Boyang, where the Imperial fleet is. Nija thinks that Jin Zha's reckless actions are meant to impress Vesra and the Hesperians. Jin Zha moves the fleet up a tributary to avoid floating explosives, adding another week to the journey. However, this alternate path is laced with submarine explosives that begin setting ships on fire. Just as Jin Zha, Rin, and Katei's ship enters danger, Nija uses shamanic powers to envelop their ships in protective water. Rin rushes to Nija as he collapses. The source of his pain is a large moving dragon tattoo on his back. He begs Rin to kill him, but she can't. Rin forces Nija to swallow opium nuggets to cut off his access to the spirit realm. Later, Nija's family doctor tells Rin that Nija has suffered from quote-unquote seizures since childhood. Rin sleeps in Nija's hospital room. When he wakes, she asks him why he didn't tell her he was a shaman. He doesn't answer, but he protests when she leaves the room. So she holds his hand while he sleeps. The army has mass cremations. Rin asks August what his religion thinks happens to people after death, and she is intrigued by the idea of an afterlife. Nija tries to avoid Rin. When she confronts him, he at first denies his powers. Then he confesses he doesn't want them because the god, quote-unquote, wants to take over. Rin says she can help him control his powers, and accuses him of hiding his useful power while people are dying. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 19. Mass grave of frozen corpses, including children, forces them into some introspection. Rin especially pauses to consider the number of dead and displaced due to their actions. Quote, the numbers add up so quickly, end quote. I used to think that a bunch of dead and dying children would give anyone pause. Gaza broke that part of me in a big way. The people who still support Israel after the atrocities committed, well, I guess they're just Americans. We've written off so much of the sins of our past and now appear poised to run them back. I lost the thread there some. Not completely, but if I kept going, I'd be here for a while. So, circling back, I hate the capitalist pigs ruined the quote-unquote numbers quote. I know I've said it before. One death in war is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. So a bunch of dead kids and their families, even if a statistic should hopefully give most people pause, it reminds me of the quote, are we the baddies quote meme, and it brings about some retrospection and hopefully a tough conversation, which we'll never have because we never do. Yet still, they march on. A strategic target awaits. And so, due to negligence and arrogance, they find themselves again in the shit. Nija uses, as of now unknown, shamanic ability to save them. A little deus ex machina there. They lose a water guy and gain a water guy. But I guess I'll let it stand. Having never focused, parenthetically, and even refusing to acknowledge it in some way, in parenthetical, he's at the beginning stages. However, his god must be aggressive because he asks for the mercy of death. Given the god, as they do, demands full control. Maybe he's just weak. Spoiled little rich boy of the emperor can't handle a little challenge from a water guard. Sorry, just couldn't help myself. I had to take a jab at the rich assholes again. It's my favorite pastime. And they deserve the hate. Plus, despite what the simps say, all of our problems are due to them. All of them. Chapter 20 Summary. Jin Zha orders them to develop plans to attack Boyang. Rin says Jin Zha's soldiers are worth more than his ego, and when Nija defends her, Jin Zha hits him. In private, Rin compares Jin Zha's actions to Altan's. This offends Nija, who calls her and Altan spearly trash. When Nija leaves, Katei tells Rin he doesn't know whether they can win in Boyang, but they have no choice but to continue. As they continue, prisoners of war die of overwork, and everyone is exhausted. When they reach Lake Boyang, they find that the Republican's fleet's superior technology isn't useful when overcome by the Imperial fleet's superior numbers in the lake's tight quarters. The Empire takes over a Republican tower ship. Suddenly, the wind stops. Through a spyglass, Rin sees Phelan, the shaman possessed by his wind god. She tries to stop him, and Phelan tortures Rin by flinging her around in the air, holding her underwater, and buffeting her with hard winds. Chagan and Kara try to stop him, and are thwarted. Rin calls Nija a coward for doing nothing as Phelan tears apart the deck of their ships. Rin and Katei fall into the water, and are whisked over a waterfall. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 20. Even though she settled into her role as a foot soldier, Rin isn't making any friends. She pisses off Jin Zha, then Nija. When all is said and done, only Katei sympathizes and supports her. Good old Katei. The only motherfucker that's kept his head through this whole thing. Three cheers for Katei. Hip hip hooray. Hip hip hooray. Hip hip hooray. At least in the case of Jin Zha, she has a point. Even Katei tries to talk some sense into him about what he proposes. And Nija, too. There's too much that can go wrong that could cause it to all go tits up. Seriously, what they get about this yet? When Katei speaks, you fucking listen to the guy. But Jin Zha is a stubborn bastard, and he doesn't listen. It's revealed that some of the hesitation comes due to pressure from the Hesperians. Jinza bought what they're selling and will rush everything in order to impress them. That includes putting his entire fleet and navy at risk. I talked about it last time, that siren song of colonialism is a strong one. You always have those D-bags willing to fuck everyone for a taste of that mother's milk. Wow, that was a gross metaphor. Jared, keep it in. Nobody listens anyway. But seriously, Hesperians are Olympic level colonizers. They make the Americans and the Brits look like... Sorry, we went to the British Museum today. I had to make that observation. I'd be doing all this a disservice if I didn't. So yeah, Jinza got promised something by the Hesperians and is willing to trade everything for that. Rin, in spite of herself, got that one right. But she pushes too far and Nisha finally unloads on her. He invokes quote-unquote spearly trash, and it obviously hurts. She shuts down Kate when he tries to joke about it. Then later, when Phelan fucks them all up, Rin lashes out and calls him a coward. Nisha, I mean. Having little to no survival instinct when others are in trouble, I'd probably have done everything, including my power, to help them. But things are different for Nisha. He obviously feels uncomfortable with the power and went to great lengths to hide it. He must have a good reason for doing so. So she probably went too far. Then again, the dipshit has to drop racism into the chat. But at this point, unless things change, they're back on the enemy side of frenemies. Truthfully, I'm not sure what can be done to salvage it this time. Then again, I thought that before. Let's see where the story takes them. Chapter 21 Summary. Rin washes to shore a mile downstream with Kate, Chagan, Kara, and a handful of Grey Company, including August. They're found by fur-clad riders. The lead rider, Vector, is Chagan and Kara's cousin. Vector's forces are hunting Phelan. Chagan and Kara's aunt, a tribal leader called the Sorkan Sira, questions Rin on her past. The Sorkan Sira reveals that Chagan's assignment was to, quote-unquote, observe and call shamans when necessary. His mother, Caligon, created the Sika as an experiment to see whether Nakara could handle communing with the gods. The Sorkan Sira says that Nakara abused their connections to the gods by calling them into the world. She shows Rin a vision of herself and Caligon as youths, meeting with a young trifecta. A Caitriad named Tsaveri tells the trifecta that her kind taught them things no Nakara has ever known. The Caitriads want to teach the trifecta how to safely use power, but the trifecta say they've anchored themselves to each other for stability, and I want to call the gods for military might. They use their powers to kill and conquer the Caitriads. The Sorkan Sira investigates Rin's memories and sees the seal. She deduces that Daji is afraid of Rin and agrees to let Rin live. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 21. Okay, is this a switch? We have the petty squabbling of mortals and have the war between the gods? It nearly breaks out between Chagan and Rin. He gets the chance to give her the old what for. He scolds her for who she is and who he thinks she should be. He chastises her for her loyalty to Vesra as a replacement for Altan. I mean, he's not wrong. She far too easily caved and gave up her status and command over the Sika. Sure, Vesra, Jinza, and then Nisha kicked her around. And yes, she's currently powerless. However, yeah, I mean, she got smacked down pretty hard. I know I probably wouldn't have lasted even as long as she did. But she gets two pieces of good news. The first, the genocide of the Caitriads by the trifecta. Wait, now genocide is good? Well, no, but the fallout from this revelation can only be positive for Rin. It challenges her view of power and legacy. When all you know is the hierarchy of society, that makes it more difficult to challenge that authority. Sure, she pushed against them and decisions that she considered poor, but when challenged herself, she quickly caved every single time. Seeing, again, in such stark detail that someone in power used that power to quell dissent through violence should push her to question even harder those in power. Vesra talks of democracy, but his main goals are to expand his power and authority. That goes double for Daji. While Rin hated Daji, some of that was blind rage. Seeing Daji's actions of murder, and with Jiang at her side, first shakes her. Then, though, it focuses her anger. She's willing to work with the Sorkan Sara in order to defeat Daji. And now she learns that Daji fears her. Why should Daji fear Rin? What does that mean for Rin in the future? Well, clearly Rin's power far surpasses even her wildest dreams. If, when, she defeats the Seal to open her power, the Sorkan Sara believes that she can learn to control that power. Unlike the rest of the Spearlies, she is not quote-unquote unstable. Are we sure about that? And will be the one to work with her god to bring about the end of Daji's reign of terror. Spoiler alert! Chapter 22 Summary. The Caitriads construct a hut for sweat, hoping it will draw out the poison in Rin's seal. if Rin can resist the temptation of her visions. Rin resists Altan and the vision several times. She stabs him with the trident, realizing she must, quote, stop chasing the legacy, end quote, he left her. The Sorcon Sira extract Daiji's venom. Rin has a blackened handprint on her chest, which is a mark of, quote, Altan's work and legacy, end quote. Rin feels a new freedom. She can access her memories better. She tries to call the fire, but discovers that the seal is still in effect. Rin takes another step forward. During her visions, she fights against Altan and ultimately stabs him. While an obvious metaphor, the conversation leading up to it proves both enlightening and maybe even revolutionary. Altan strikes at her at every level. He says some of the same things as Shagun. He adds some of his own insults. Honestly, nothing new. However, her response to the barbs take on a new air of defiance. She responds, quote, you can't say anything to hurt me anymore, end quote. So he tries a different tact. You capture more flies with honey, so to speak. So he goes the love route. While willing to have the conversation and even make some concessions, ultimately she brushes it all off. One may argue that she's been here before and nothing changed before. Okay, fair enough. However, this time she also fought back against him. And then, yes, she stabbed him. When the wound wasn't fatal and he persisted, so did she. She is on the road to recovery, I think. In another obvious metaphor, a blackened hand appears on her chest. She recognizes it immediately as Altan's mark and legacy. Even with him gone, his influence remains. That's why I say she's just on the road to recovery. She still has some things to deal with and some healing to do. She still can't call out the fire. When she tries and fails, the ghost of Altan laughs at her. Even so, the fire gives her a taste of what she's missing. All these developments lead her to believe that things might just be a bit different this time. Whether she trades Altan for another manipulative mentor remains to be seen. Chapter 23 Summary. The Sorcon Sira says that if Rin has a quote-unquote anchor bond to call the god for her, like with Shagun and Kara, she'll have access to her power again. Kate agrees. Rin doesn't want him to be corrupted by the influence of the Phoenix, but he insists. Kara says the bond will make Rin quote-unquote more stable and less likely to quote-unquote lose her mind. On the other hand, Rin and Kate's lives will be linked together. They'll die when the other does. They could break their bond with their last word, but the anchor will tie together their thoughts so completely that, quote, most would rather die than give that up, end quote. The trifecta undertook an unstable three-way anchor bond that magnified their power. As they perform the ritual, Rin and Kate see all the other secrets, memories, thoughts, and feelings. Rin feels spiritually elated. She doesn't realize she's, quote-unquote, erasing Kate from existence. When she hears his voice, she stabs herself to disconnect from the power, successfully ending the ritual. After this, Rin can successfully call a fire and manipulate it with ease. There's a wall in her mind now between her and the Phoenix. That night, Rin asks Kara if Shagun ever dominates their bond. Rin worries about erasing Kate, but Kara thinks Rin can, quote, trust herself to protect him, end quote. Rin wonders if Kara and Shagun, who are Naimads rather than the Katriads, miss their home. Shagun says the Katriads blame their mother for the trifecta and treat the twins like, quote unquote, slaves. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 23. An admission. I need to suspend my disbelief quite more than average with these books. Not that they are fantastical and supernatural. That comes with the territory of the genre. But the nature with which knowledge is gained and shared always seems a bit convenient for me. The whole concept of a bond and the trifecta being hidden for so long is just now coming to light, only two chapters after the entire first half of the book renders Rin powerless. Parenthetically, if anybody listens, I'm parenthetical. Elsa skeptical? No? Just shut up and enjoy it? Okay, but let me finish. The main reason that I snap back into the story is that I remember that Kwong was a teenager when she started writing the books. And the story was so compelling that it still got published. As a frustrated former writer, I can relate to and appreciate that. Okay, mini sermon over. Let's talk about the chapter. Kate, who as you know is my favorite, can act as a bond for Rin to gain back her power. While presented primarily as a strategic move, if Rin gains back her power, they can use that in the war effort. Realistically, it can end the war fairly quickly. Rin initially protests to the suggestion. Kate is more open to the process when given the chance. He tries to convince her that it is a good idea. While still skeptical, she eventually capitulates because of wanting the fire back. The point of all this is that I wanted to discuss Kate's reasons for being on board. Back to that. I said earlier the part is no doubt strategic. The question arises whether love plays any part. For her part, Rin probably can't imagine such a thing. What she knows is love comes from a place of fear and respect. Katea, however, has had some time, parenthetically, or just dedicated himself more, in parenthetical, to coming to terms with his place and role in the world. I think he's more capable of showing that love. He's willing to give up part of himself to help his friend. That is, a selfless act of love. There is no question in my mind. Now Rin reacts to this with her usual tactic of pushing people away. She feels like she is a racing Kite. She believes her power is enough to break his body and soul. This is very much in keeping with her view on the world. Power and might makes right and ground all under its heel. It remains to be seen if the power of love ultimately reigns. Which I believe it does, but let's see if Guang does. Chapter 24 Summary. The next morning, the Sorkon Seer prepares them to leave, trusting that Rin will kill Daji. As Kara and Chagan get ready to see Rin and Kite off, they hear explosions from camp. They discover that the Hesperian missionaries have their arquebuses back and are killing Kaitreids. The Sorkon Seer tells Bector to kill August before he kills Rin, and they realize Bector gave them back their weapons in a coup. Bector wants all shamans to die in revenge for Tsaveri's life. All the Kaitreids have secretly turned against the Sorkon Seer, thinking her too lenient on the Naimans and Nakara. August kills the Sorkon Seer. Kara jumps in front of Chagan, taking a bullet for him. Rin kills August and Bector and his men right away. Chagan wants to die with Kara, but she thinks he is too important to die. She dissolves the anchor bod and dies alone. With the Sorkon Seer dead and Bector chieftain, Chagan goes to warn the Naimans. Now for my thoughts on Chapter 24. Well, shit, that surprised even me. It makes sense because the Hesperians believe themselves to be better than the others. Moreover, many of those people either believe the same or are unable to fight back for one reason or another. The colonists usurp the customs and traditions of the people that they colonize and replace them with their own cultures. Of course, they would betray and attempt to exterminate the Kaitreids. Moreover, they created a coup. Now that I hear myself saying it, it makes perfect sense, and yet I fell for the old okey-doke. The feel-good of Rin getting back her power got me. Plus, Kuang is famous, parenthetically, at least in these books, for thumping you on the head with some real bad shit after giving you just a bit of hope. God damn it. It brings us to Kara. Her act of breaking the bond to allow Chagan to live contrasts with the new bond between Kite and Rin. Until Rin comes to terms with, well, everything that she has going on, she will continue to fuck things up. As I wrote before, we will see whether Kite's love or her power will win out. Right now, it isn't looking good for love. Maybe that's just some of my pessimism of real life bleeding through once again. At least Kara comes through with her act of love and sacrifice. Maybe that's Mark stumping inside of Rin finally. I'm not holding my breath at this point. My big fear is that to repeat this scene in some way with Kite sacrificing himself for Rin, and maybe that's when she finally breaks? She sees his love for what it was, that drives her to her higher purpose. Ultimately, things work out, and there's at least a calm to lead forward, if not a lasting peace. But my petty ass is still going to be upset that Kite died. Well, a lot happening in this section. Let's get to my final thoughts, and then we can close out. We have three major themes colliding in this section. Two persist through the entire series, colonialism and Rin's constantly shifting identity. Another is constantly in the background and surfaces more directly every now and then. Slavery. Rin's life at the beginning of the first book more or less is slavery. Sex slaves in the prostitution houses of Golanese. Various groups of people forced into indentured servitude as civilians and in the military. The reason I bring it up is in the context of colonialism. The ever-expanding reach of capital requires ever more exploitation of resources, natural, material, and yes, human. It means that they have to scout new places to find that human capital, parenthetically, their fucking words, not mine, in parenthetical, in order to exploit more efficiently. Eventually end up with slavery or something very close to that. Shit was made in China, then Indonesia, then Vietnam. Now is it made in Laos? I don't know where it's made, so that they can extract every last dollar for their fucking shareholder piece of shit. Sorry. Moving on. The argument always ends up being, quote, well, they're getting paid. How is that slavery? End quote. But it's the same disingenuous argument that they've always used. Hell, already a president just made the argument that slavery wasn't so bad because they gave the slaves shelter, food, and they learned valuable skills. Of all the goddamn bullshit slippery slope arguments I've listened to over the last few decades, this is an actual slippery slope that ends with the subjugation and degradation of an entire race of people. So fuck the president and double fuck that sentient penis Stephen Miller. Okay, got some things off my chest there. Now, slavery in the book comes up in the context of shamanism. The shamans become slaves to their gods. An interesting take for a couple of reasons. One, I never considered that as a possibility. You trade, parenthetically. I guess I never considered what, but it is obviously steep, in parenthetical, for the superpower. You trade your sanity, your freedom, and ultimately your life. Yes, damn, it is absolutely a form of slavery, but one from which there may be no freedom or escape other than death. Heavy. The other reason is that perhaps Kuang is making the argument that all religious people are slaves. that simultaneously intrigues me and fucks me up. Like, it's the kind of thing that I often say during one of my rants. But to hear it from someone else, that legitimizes it. Makes you think, what are the ramifications of such a situation? Does it make religion even worse than I thought? Everybody consider religion, parenthetically. Well, right, Christian nationalism, whatever the fuck Netanyahu uses to justify his bullshit, and the perversion of Islam that leads to their atrocities, and parenthetical, to be a net negative. Does this push it further? Or is it just another way to frame what I just said? Those in power use religion as a justification to their followers for the horrors they perpetrate. Now that I parse it, I think that's it. Because otherwise, I need to be doing much more to break through other than making magical space dad comments and jokes. I should be working to free people from their bonds. The thing is that religion can, parenthetically and should, be a force for good. Maybe that's the compromise. Reward the good behavior and shame the bad. Dang, there's some shit going on here. Almost makes the final point of discussion a bit anticlimactic. Let's paint it as a palate cleanser to make the end of the show slightly less of a bummer. I wish I didn't ever have to discuss this one again. I'd much rather talk about Kate or even Vanka, but Rin is the protagonist, so nominally she's the reason for the story. Maybe I'm being too harsh on the girl. After all, I hated Destina for a good part of the Dragonlance trilogy, and even questioned her motives late in those books. But this is different. Rin is taking absolutely no responsibility for anything. She bounces from identity to identity, and I think it's all just to avoid having to contend with who she really is. Okay, some of that is due to the fact that she's very young, never developed much of an identity other than in school. Then she left there, it severed her tether, and she started to wander again. It doesn't help that nearly every mentor or role model dies or otherwise leaves. The only real stable presence in her life is Kate, and he's her polar opposite in many ways. It might be good for her if she possesses any sense of self, but it just becomes another adversarial relationship. Hopefully she realizes sooner rather than later what a benefit an ally like Kate is. I have a feeling she will not. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic because things look so grim right now. But hey, I've been wrong before. Kong has a way of making me lose all faith before restoring it unexpectedly. Hopefully that's what happens with Rin and Kate. Because otherwise, this entire thing will have been for nothing. And seriously, that will piss me the fuck off. So what do you guys think? Am I making good points here? Or am I completely off my rocker? It could go either way. It's not like I'm not willing to admit when I'm wrong and come around to other points of view. So if you have anything else out there that you'd like to run by me, by all means, drop it in the comments, email me, find me on the various social media platforms, whatever you gotta do to get it across. Because, as always, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. You don't have to, but you've chosen to, and that means a lot to me. You can find us, if you haven't already yet, www.twoguysgaming.net. I've been doing about one article a week there. I'm also pretty active on TikTok, although I've slowed down a little bit over the last couple of days. I'll pick that back up now that I'm home and things are moving in a consistent direction. NoobDad76 there. I'm also on YouTube, which should be picking up over the next week or so. I'm trying to get Twitch up and running over the next week or so. So yeah, we got some big things happening, and hopefully some of them will pay off in the end. I'm not as active on Instagram or Facebook because I really don't like what is happening there. And I'm not active at all on Twitter or Blue Sky because they just seem like polar opposites of one another in every way. And I'm not interested in that. If you can convince me to use any one of those because you use them more often and we can stay in touch better, then, you know, make your argument and we'll see. I'll be back with this series sometime this week. I start back to school tomorrow, but the next couple of days are only PD and working in my classroom, so I should have some time to jot down some notes for at least part 5 and hopefully part 6. And then, yeah, next month I'll be back with the Red Mars. I think that's all I have to say for now. These last couple episodes have been a little bit longer. Hopefully you like the new format. I will talk to you next time. Bye, guys.